At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Think about Iraq for a second and ask yourself this. When the fighting starts, where do the civilians go? Foreign aid and refugees on the program today. Also, political ads and improv comedy. Two different stories on those. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Cleveland, Ohio, today from the studios of WCPN, I'm Kai Rizdal. Great to have you here on this Thursday, everybody. It's the 19th of June, and the political military word of the day today is targeted, as in targeted military action in Iraq should the president decide it's necessary. That was the upshot of remarks President Obama made at the White House today. Up to 300 military advisors are on their way to Iraq, as is Secretary of State John Kerry. But already happening on the ground is this. Hundreds of thousands of Iraqis who've been displaced just this month. And the big question now is how to care for them. You add Iraq into what's happening next door in Syria, a humanitarian crisis that has already exhausted donor countries and private individuals. And it is a big, giant mess. Marketplace and Noel King gets us going.
Many aid workers in the region fear that Iraq will go the way of Syria.
There is real fears that it will escalate to that status.
Some people are better off than others.
They can be like middle income. They could be like, you know, rich folks. They could be like poor people. All of them just fled the city because when there is like a security situation like that, the most important thing is you think about is your life and how to safeguard your family.
Many who fled do have the means to survive at first. But if they can't return home after a few days...
As the situation goes on, people run out of money.
Ariane Rummery is a spokesperson for the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees.
We've met a lot of people, for example, who might be staying in a cheap hotel. They might be sharing a single hotel room with three other families. But they tell us that they only have enough money for like one or two nights accommodation.
After that, Rummery says the options are a refugee camp or one of the shelters that have sprung up in mosques, schools, and abandoned buildings. If the crisis grows, funding could be a real problem. The UN Refugee Agency's $4 million appeal for Syria is only 36% funded. A similar appeal for Iraqis displaced by fighting earlier this year is only 12% funded. Stephen Claiborne is the Iraq Country Director for Mercy Corps. He says a combination of donor fatigue and tough economic times means donor governments are strapped.
For the big donor governments around the world, these are serious budgetary times for them, and this is a part of the world that they've been engaged in for a long time.
And while compared with Syria's 9 million displaced, a few hundred thousand Iraqis fleeing Mosul seems like a small number. But Claiborne points out just 2 years ago, there weren't 9 million displaced Syrians. There were a few hundred thousand. I'm Noel King for Marketplace.
The corporate news of the day has a certain deja vu all over again quality to it. American Apparel has fired CEO and founder Dove Charney. Charney has been called colorful. He has been called controversial. In letting him go last night, the company's board of directors called it an investigation into alleged misconduct. CEOs get fired all the time, but it becomes much more complicated when the CEO is the founder, especially when that CEO is as visible as Charney was, often in the public eye, making the case for the company's sexy ads and Made in America motif. Marketplace's Mark Garrison reports now on the tricky business of firing a founder.
Chopping off the head of the person who started it all is risky, so boards and investors are often slow to do it. Dave Logan is a management consultant who also teaches at USC's business school.
Almost always the decision is made to oust a founder when it just becomes intolerable. The amount of evidence, the amount of risk just reaches that overwhelming point.
Even so, it's not easy to fire a founder.
Usually the founder owns a lot of the company's stock. Usually the founder has a lot of people who are still loyal to him or her at the company. So it's not something to be undertaken lightly.
Chris Yeh is a Silicon Valley startup investor, so he knows how messy this can get.
There are all these fallouts that come out of ousting a founder. Bad publicity, dirty laundry, potentially even lawsuits.
The company's profits and reputation have to be at great risk for a company to axe a founder. In the fashion world, American Apparel and Men's Warehouse did so for different reasons. But those perhaps most at risk, young tech company founders, backed by venture capital. Dartmouth management professor Sidney Finkelstein says investors don't play around.
They're looking for quicker returns, and if they're not going to get it, they're going to make the tougher move, and so founder CEOs are going to be at bigger risk. But it comes with the territory. If you're willing to take their money, that's part of the deal.
Groupon founder Andrew Mason learned that, but took the bullet with humor in a remarkable public goodbye letter. He started with the standard leaving to spend time with family bit. And then, just kidding, I was fired today. He won't be the last. I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
We had Dove Charney on the program a couple of months ago. It was, shall we say, an interesting interview. We'll play some of it a bit later on. On Wall Street today, slow start, slow finish, too. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Republicans in the House sorted out their leadership team this afternoon. Kevin McCarthy of California is going to replace Eric Cantor as majority leader, as had been widely predicted. The action shifts to the Senate next week. There's a big primary runoff down in Mississippi on Tuesday. Longtime Senator Thad Cochran is trying to hold off challenger Chris McDaniel with the GOP nomination in that state in the balance. Outside groups have poured millions of dollars into that race, just as they've poured money into primaries across the country. In Mississippi, it's Tea Party groups on one side, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce on the other. And that pro-business group has retooled its strategy and is spending more money than it ever has in a way that it never has. Marketplace's David Gura reports.
So far, the 2014 primary season has been busy and expensive with a familiar cacophonous soundtrack.
We know Thad Cochran has been in Washington for 5 decades, and that's way too long.
Meet the real Chris McDaniel, a personal injury class action trial lawyer.
At the end of that second ad is a tagline that's probably familiar to voters in many states.
The U.S. Chamber is responsible for the content of this advertising.
The Chamber of Commerce has been around since 1912, and it has some 3 million members.
This year, we've taken the most aggressive posture that we ever have.
That's Rob Engstrom, who's really responsible for the content of that ad, along with dozens of others like it. He's the Chamber's national political director.
2014 will be the largest political program in the history of the Chamber of Commerce in the United States.
In 2012, it shelled out more than $34 million trying to defeat President Obama and trying to help Republicans regain control of the Senate.
After having squandered collectively 5 Senate seats over the last 2 elections, we thought it was important to involve ourselves and engage ourselves using the Chamber's brand.
The Chamber is spending more money, and it started spending it earlier on candidates in primaries across the country. This decision came out of a meeting Engstrom convened last year in Phoenix. He says it was a constructive conversation and that big donors were candid and direct. The upshot?
We're ready to turn the page and get back on offense.
So far, the Chamber has had a winning season. It backed Mike Simpson in Idaho and Mitch McConnell in Kentucky in their races against Tea Party challengers. Bob Biersack is with the Center for Responsive Politics.
I can't think of an example where they've really made a big investment and not had it succeed this year.
In the run-up to 2012, conservative groups spent about $700 million. Well, there's a lot of outside money this time around, but Biersack says it's being spent differently.
It's being spent more professionally, I guess I would say.
Rob Engstrom with the Chamber of Commerce says the group's members expect that. They're executives and business owners.
You know, our members are bottom line people.
And in politics, as in business, they want a good ROI, a good return on their investments. Well, it's up to Engstrom and his team to spend donors' dollars wisely. An investor does due diligence. Engstrom says he meets personally with 150 candidates every cycle. He says he's looking for people who are pro-business, who have a shot at winning.
All of these guys go home and campaign as conservatives, as fiscal conservatives.
Russ Walker has been on the other side in these primary battles.
But at the end of the day, that's not always how they govern.
Walker is with Freedom Works Action, a Tea Party group that spent more than $425,000 on the Republican primary in Mississippi. Well, its donors also care about ROI, the return on their investments. But Walker invests their money differently, less on ads and more on getting Freedom Works Action's members knocking on doors.
They are the best communicator of that political message. They can carry on a conversation, whereas if we run a 30 or 60 second spot, that's really all we get is 30 or 60 seconds.
That's a strategy many conservative groups seem to favor at the national and the local level. Case in point, what happened to House Majority Leader Eric Cantor. Even if they won't say so, these groups are fighting over nothing less than the future of the Republican Party. That's serious business for Freedom Works Action's Russ Walker and the Chamber of Commerce's Rob Engstrom.
You know, we're going to fight back, and we are going to involve ourselves in an aggressive manner with good manners and high integrity, and then it's going to be a barroom brawl.
The Chamber and Tea Party groups will try to land a few more punches this weekend before the runoff Tuesday. Then their focus shifts to the general election in November. After all, these are long-term investors. I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
There's a new mystery novel out today that we can virtually guarantee you is going to be a blockbuster. The Silkworm, it's called. It's the latest from author Robert Galbraith, which possibly means nothing to you until I tell you Robert Galbraith is a pseudonym for J.K. Rowling, who invented a kid named Harry Potter. Sadly, you are not going to be able to get The Silkworm from Amazon right away because it is published by Hachette. And Hachette is in the throes of a struggle with Amazon over the terms of their contract. Amazon has been blocking its customers from pre-ordering new Hachette titles and delaying sales of existing Hachette books. But as Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports, independent bookstores are capitalizing big time.
You couldn't pre-order the book on Amazon, but consumers could pre-order The Silkworm from Carmichael's bookstore in Louisville, Kentucky.
On sale today, and if you look up Amazon's website, it says available in 2 to 4 weeks.
That's owner Michael Boggs. He's taken to Twitter to advertise that he carries the same Hachette books as Amazon, only his store won't make you wait a month to take delivery. He says consumers ask about the dispute between Hachette and Amazon.
We've kind of taken advantage of it by pushing Hachette books, doing a little window of Hachette books saying, you can buy these here today.
Big retailers like Walmart and Barnes & Noble have also capitalized on the Amazon standoff by offering discounts on Hachette books. But independent bookstores may stand to benefit most. Wyatt Wagerzin co-owns Bookworks in Albuquerque. He appreciates Amazon for making it hard to buy certain books online.
It's a great advantage if someone doesn't want to sell a book. Then I have the opportunity to get that sale.
Amazon's tactics with Hachette have backfired in terms of public relations. Consumer Jim Dembowski from Lubbock, Texas, used to buy a lot of books on Amazon.
It's made me think twice about how much I want to patronize Amazon.
He prefers to support independent stores. He left the shop in Albuquerque after buying about a dozen books. The owner put stickers on them that he downloaded from the website of humorist and Hachette author Stephen Colbert. The stickers read, I didn't buy it on Amazon. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Coming up, life doing improv comedy.
If you talk to my parents, you'll realize I hear it a lot. Like, when are you going to make it? Or go back to grad school.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is up 14 points today, about a 10%, finished at 16,921, getting closer every day, gang. The NASDAQ retreated 3 points, less than a 10%, closed at 4359. The S&P 500 up 2 points, a 10%, ended things at 1959. BlackBerry is apparently back from the dead. The stock trailed up 9.3% today after reporting smaller than expected losses. Starbucks frothed up more than 2% after an analyst upgrade. American Apparel shareholders love the CEO getting fired. Stock put on 6.7% today, and you're listening to Marketplace. Marketplace is a nonprofit, listener-supported program, and your support in any amount helps us keep on telling the stories behind the business and economic news of the day. So please help us end our budget year strong by giving at Marketplace.org by June 30th.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Friday. In Washington, a House Judiciary Subcommittee holds a hearing on net neutrality and antitrust law. Used car retailer CarMax releases quarterly earnings. And Jaws, that cute flick about a pesky shark, opened to movie-going audiences on June 20th, 1975, just in time for summer. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. How many times have you guys heard this line? Small businesses are the engine of job growth in our economy. Lots of times, right? Well, as it happens, we just cut and pasted that line from the White House website. Although, to be fair, it's a refrain politicians of all stripes do love to repeat. But is it true? Kate Davidson reports.
Economist John Haltewanger of the University of Maryland has studied this very question. His response?
I would say no, not at least in the way the politicians have described it.
He says it's not size that matters, but age. He says it's young companies, and not all young companies, just a few, that are engines of job growth. Haltewanger says the economy is full of churn. In a good year, hundreds of thousands of new businesses create at least one job.
And it turns out most of those businesses either failed or didn't grow. But a small fraction of those businesses really take off. And in the economics literature, we've begun to think about those businesses as transformational entrepreneurs.
Think about your Facebooks, your Twitters. Starting small and growing big is part of the American dream.
But in truth, most small businesses are dry cleaners and dentists.
Eric Hurst is a professor of economics at the Booth School of Business.
Dry cleaners and dentists tend to start small and stay small for almost their whole existence.
Just the size they should be. Jared Bernstein with the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities says we lavish too much policy love on small businesses just because they're small.
I think we should help small businesses, say, break into export markets where they face barriers. I think we should help small businesses have access to credit markets.
He says policies should nurture survival because he thinks businesses that start out small and grow older and bigger are the ones that add the most employment in the long run. I'm Kate Davidson for Marketplace.
The World Cup and its associated happenings down in Brazil are what you'd rightly call a global advertising bonanza. There are companies spending tens and tens and tens of millions of dollars to be official partners and sponsors. But if you've watched any of the games on TV, you've probably noticed a big difference from other sports on the tube. Not all that many commercial breaks. Dan Bobkoff explains.
Remember this Super Bowl ad with a puppy falling in love with a Clydesdale? Budweiser scored big with this one. But you don't see as many ads like this at the World Cup.
The World Cup is an anomaly because you're not getting the same type of commercials every 10 minutes, every 20 minutes.
Ben Sterner is CEO of a sports marketing firm called The Leverage Agency. While there are few commercial breaks, all around the Brazil stadiums you see logos for international brands like Coca-Cola and Adidas. You see ads on uniforms, even on the screen itself.
Having a static ad in the background, it may not give you the exact messaging in a commercial ad, but you're getting minutes and minutes of time, and your brand, it has association with the highest level.
This works really well for big brands we already know, says Professor Gerardo Tellis of USC, who studies advertising effectiveness.
All you want is lots of exposure and lots of reminders.
He says it raises the probability that we'll choose Coke over Pepsi or McDonald's over Burger King. He says anyway, 30-second ads have been losing effectiveness. It's now about getting a viral hit online, which can also save a company a lot of money. That's what headphone maker Beats by Dre managed. It released a 5-minute video online showing players arriving while wearing its headphones. Never mind that FIFA actually banned Beats from the World Cup because only Sony paid the big bucks to be an official sponsor. The Beats film already has more than 17 million views on YouTube. I'm Dan Bobkoff from Marketplace.
There's a place here in Los Angeles that for the past 40 years has been the place where comedy legends are born. It's called Groundlings. And I said it's a place, which it is. It's a theater and an improv school, but it's also kind of an attitude or a mindset, maybe. And even if you haven't heard of Groundlings itself, you've probably heard of some of the people who got their start there.
I'm Ron Burgundy. You stay classy, San Diego.
Smelly cat, what are they feeding you? Everybody!
1 year ago today, Kim Jong-un ascended to power by climbing onto a phone book.
One afternoon a couple of weeks ago, the place was busy. People practicing lines, just hanging out, going over bits as well. So we stepped into a side office with two people who've been at Groundlings for a while.
I am Lisa Sherga, and I started taking classes at the Groundlings in 2002, and I became a Groundling in 2007. So I've
Groundling,
been with the company.
You say it like it's a badge of honor.
It is. I think it is. It is for me anyways. It was my why I moved here from Boston, was mainly to become a Groundling. Anything else on top of that is gravy, but this is what I wanted to do. So
my story's a little different. My name's Ryan Gall, and I actually moved here from Boston, in 2003. And this was my first stop, literally my first stop, because somebody had told me a long time ago, if you want to do something in entertainment, find out where the best people do it and go there and copy them. So I have, for the last 10 years, copied people.
What, fair to say that you guys, not you guys, but the decades past have shaped American comedy?
Oh, wow.
Yeah. You know, we're basically a minor league for Saturday Night Live.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
And I, you know, it feels like a lot of people, you know, you say that to and they're like, really? And then you start listing names that have come out of here and gone Saturday Night Live. And it's like, yeah, you know, there's a reason Lorne Michaels comes here several times a year and just watches shows. It really pushes me individually. And I think a lot of us Groundlings, we're like, we got to keep this name where it's at. And
so what will be your all's definition of made it, right? What's next for you? Because there's going to come a point where you're like, oh God, Groundlings again? On a Sunday or whatever it is.
Well, I mean, and this is the thing about the Groundlings. Like, you may not know us by name because we're not fancy and on a billboard, but this guy, you know, just always works.
And that's all you want as an actor, right? You just want to work.
That for me is making it, is being working regularly. I mean, everybody would love the dream, I guess, of your own show. You wrote it, you're in it, all that stuff. But
we're not all Kristen Wiig again.
No.
Yeah.
No. It's a frustrating thing to hear that. And if you talk to my parents, you'll realize I hear it a lot. Like, when are you going to make it? Like, go back to grad school. But it's frustrating because you never ask a teacher, like, when
are you going to make it? When are you going to get that job at Harvard?
When are you like a chef? Like, it's just not something you do. But I guess it is really cool that we get to put on these shows in front of so many people. I don't need more. If I die tomorrow, which I could, you don't know.
It's LA, man. It's a tough tomorrow. Town.
I could die tomorrow. I'm going to try to die tomorrow.
Just to wrap it up. Not before this airs, though, right?
No. I gotta reek the bennies.
Everyone would listen to this.
Yeah.
Tomorrow.
Oh my God, well, certainly everybody here.
That
anyway.
Guy died. He said it, and then he
last did. Interview. Oh my God, what has happened to me? Can you guys make a living teaching and working here and then getting occasional commercials?
Mm-hmm.
Can you really?
Absolutely, yeah.
What?
Yeah.
I've made, and this is not to brag, $30 million this year.
Yeah, it's there
no,
you go.
You're not going to... you're not going to
you're not gonna
you know,
get
buy
rich.
A Tesla, you know, teaching here. But I would say there are people that survived just teaching here.
Is this a good time to be in comedy, sort of writ large?
I think it's such that to me is a strange question.
My producer thought of it.
Yeah, could we have her leave the room?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
I'm kidding. It's a strange question only because to me, comedy is so important. I'm like, I can't think of a time where comedy wouldn't be so important.
Let me do that host thing and then change the question.
Sure,
right?
Please.
Is this a good time for you to have business opportunities, for you to have opportunities to practice your craft in comedy now?
Yeah. No, you're kidding. And
right,
you know why?
Love.
No, you know what? This is something I think it is a really good time to be in comedy because there are so many outlets. I think Microsoft is trying to get into the TV business and come up with
that's
programming.
That's not going to end well.
No, no. They just don't have the money. They don't have the money to do it.
What was your worst flop on the Groundlings?
So I was on the stage with Jill Sachoff, which if you look out on the board, she always likes to sport a very short curly wig in many of her scenes. It's her favorite look. And we were in a scene together where we had to dance a lot, dance and sing. And I had not, it was a quick change. So I was coming off of another scene. It was the first time we had done it. We rehearsed it, but I had never seen her costume or what wig she was wearing. Should have known, but I hadn't seen it. And so lights came up and we're singing, and then I turn and look at her and she's given herself a full monobrow, like really, really like thick monobrow. She had that wig on, but she had it on as far back as she could, so it looked like she was kind of balding with this curly wig, and she was dancing really hard and singing, and I peed on the stage.
Not just a little pee. She peed like a horse pees on like the street when it has to pee.
No. Nobody in the back could see it, but I made really awkward eye contact with a few people in the first two rows.
Well, thanks you guys so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ryan's got his own flop, which we have online. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the way out today, the strange case of American Apparel founder and CEO Dove Charney, who, as we said up at the top of the show, was fired last night by his board of directors. We went over to the company's factory in downtown L.A. just a couple of months ago, spent an hour or so walking around with Charney, and it quickly became clear he had some issues. So when we sat down, I asked him what his biggest weakness was.
My biggest weakness is me. I mean, lock me up already. I mean, it's obvious. Put me in a cage. I'll be fine. Okay? You know, I'm my own worst enemy.
Not your average CEO interview, right? And then after the thanks very much for your time thing that I always do, there was this.
Was too nuts or what?
That was bar none the most bizarre CEO interview I've ever had. Bar none.
Well, it's Los Angeles, man.
The whole interview is on our website. It's marketplace.org. And with that, we are out of here. John Buckley, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, George Judson, Ethan Lindsay, Dave Shaw, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. Thanks today to the staff here at WCPN in Cleveland, Ohio. I'm Kai Rizdahl. David Gurr is driving tomorrow. Have a good night, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.